All right, you good?
Yeah.
I'm Austin Luga.
I'm Andrew Harp.
This is With Nothing to Say.
Let's talk about a matter of life and death.
Before we get into this week's film, next week we're going to be watching Heaven Knows What by the Safdie brothers. I was thinking about this a lot this week because last week we talked about the breaking up, or 2 weeks ago we talked about the breaking up the Safdie brothers. At some point recently, we talked about the end of the Safdie brothers, and I was just going over that recording the other day, and there was been a lot of commotion from our loyal listeners about the Safdie brother news. Apparently they are as in the dark as I am about these sorts of things. So I've just been thinking a lot about
I don't
it.
know what you're talking about at all, but Benny Safdie, he's been really busy though this past year, as I said earlier.
Yeah.
He's been in a bunch of high profile movies, so
All right. Do you know anything about this movie, Heaven Knows What?
I know it's a miserable movie about people addicted to drugs.
Oh, fun. Sounds like a frolicking good time.
Yep, sounds pretty good.
But speaking of fantastical sort of adventures, as it were, this week we watched A Matter of Life and Death. Michael Powell and can I
Emmett
remember?
Pressburger.
Pressburger. I can never remember the other guy's name. So we've talked to him before. Have we watched one of their films on the podcast before? Or we
Yes, we
just talked?
have.
Okay. It
No, we
was
have.
the.
I know where I'm going.
Okay. That's what I thought.
You didn't realize that earlier?
I was kind of sure, but I wasn't 100% on it because I'd logged it weirdly. Because the way I log films for this podcast is a little different than how I usually log films. So sometimes I don't log them correctly, or I don't log them in my Letterboxd. So when I looked in my Letterboxd, I didn't have that film marked down as one I'd seen. I know I'd seen other Michael Powell films before. I'd seen a couple of his films before, but going into this, I distinctly remember that I know where I'm going. Which is this is a very different film in some ways. Some ways it's very similar, but in
It's
some
a
ways
better
it's very
film,
different.
but yeah, but it is very
It is a better film.
it is similar, obviously. Yeah, I'm shitting on it, but like I know where I'm going.
Yeah.
It's a cool movie, but this one is got a lot more going on, I feel.
This one is certainly a much more imaginative and
Yeah.
fantastical piece. I mean, some of these set designs are absolutely fantastic and
It's some of the
just
greatest
in.
ever stuff ever.
It blows my mind away just how big and obnoxiously flamboyant in the best of ways these set designs are, especially whenever we're in Technicolor. And I love that
You say
transition video.
flamboyant, but I think like I find them to be very modernist. They're very like they're made. I guess when you say flamboyant, you mean like they're huge. Like
Yeah.
they're these huge structures that made it look huge, even though we know it's not real, right? Like,
Yeah, it kind of has the same effect that when we were talking about American Paris last week, this sort of MGM style in the studio and yet otherworldly. I mean, we know we're on sets for most of this film, and yet these sets feel so fantastical and almost science fiction and fantasy-esque. It's truly just beautiful and vibrant and.
this movie has a lot of like similar. I thought this movie, I can't help but like connect like this movie to An American in Paris since we just watched it. There were some like similarities, I thought. There were some things that I noticed between the two that are similar, but I like it better in this movie than An American in Paris, I guess. Including a matter of life and death, like irreverence for like love and like romance and things like that. I find it to be more palpable in this movie, and I find it more convincing, I guess. Even though I don't normally gravitate toward that stuff.
No, I see what you're saying. American Paris feels very clean in its love. I'm trying to think of the word here. It's like where we sort of hide all the blemishes and buffed out almost, right? It's this very platonic almost type of love. You know, we get rid of the sex and the desire and all that and kind of bring it back to this sort of more neuterized almost love. Where in
But
this
in this
film,
movie, it's literally a matter of life and
it's
death.
literally a matter of life and death. I mean, the entire film hinges on the love of these two characters. And
Yeah.
there's something, of course, they refer many times to Shakespearean plays. They quote Shakespeare. They're putting on A Midsummer Night's Dream, which,
Yeah.
of course, a fantastical film where a bunch of people go into a
Yeah,
forest
this
to be
movie is just like
buried in
insanely
love.
intelligent. Like it's just there's something about it that is just like a very smart film.
Do you know who wrote this film?
I think it was them.
Did they write it? Because the writing
Yeah.
here is just
It's
beautiful.
really funny, by the way. I think it's funnier than like American in Paris. Like I know I hate to like compare the two. I thought this movie was really, really funny.
It is extremely funny in so many different ways, and it's funny in a very different way than An American in Paris. I know we keep going back and forth between these two films.
Both movies were made around the same time, both used like a Technicolor, both are kind of about a romantic relationship. I again, maybe it's unfair to compare the two, but I can't help it. You know, both are very like, both aren't very cynical, both are kind of like against cynicism. Again, I just find it way more convincing in this movie.
I think there's also something, even though this isn't a musical in the same way that American Paris is, there's something operatic or balletic. Or it's almost like a ballet, this film, especially in a lot of the sound design choices we have here. All those moments where we cut to a shot and they cut out all the sound except for the music. And, you know, you just see their expressions along with the music. And there's all these interpretations and moments where there's no dialogue, or the dialogue's sort of meaningless and everything's taken from the visuals, which some truly insane visuals. I mean, just the fact that they got this many extras in this film. Right. There's just so many people.
It's ridiculous. especially at the trial. That's mainly like the part you're talking about, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
oh, yeah. That trial's insane.
It's a great part of the movie. Yeah, this movie, like, yeah, you said, like, yeah, it's insane. The whole movie is insane. It has, like, a lot of, like, it has a lot of weird decisions in it that don't make really any sense, at least in terms of what you would expect from a movie, but they stick out and they're memorable, though. So, like, when you get introduced to the Roger Livesey doctor character, who's, like, the best character in the movie, when he's introduced, he's a doctor. And they mention it throughout the movie, and it's obviously that he is. But when he's introduced, he's not like in a lab coat. He's not in a doctor's office. He's like playing with his camera obscura with
his
dogs.
What is that thing?
It's called a camera obscura. It's like almost like a, I think it's almost like a, what's like one of those things that you might have like on a submarine?
Yeah, like in trench warfare, they have like the same thing, that little thing that goes over the.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think it's something like that. Like he's like able
periscope?
To kind of like look around and a periscope. Yeah, okay. I think that's basically what it is. Like it's like a periscope that he can kind of like move and turn around and be able to like look around the town or whatever. It doesn't make any sense, but like it definitely sticks out in your mind because obviously the easy thing would be to, he's a doctor, so he's in his doctor's office or he's doing this or that, but he's just playing with like this weird kind of like bygone piece of technology that people don't really have or use anymore. So that stuff I like a lot more than going again like the usual route, I guess, to introduce that character. And there's a lot of stuff like that.
Yeah, at times this movie just feels almost inhuman in some of the choices in filmmaking and such imagined choices. And I think of that moment in particular, not because it's just strange and outside of the normal, but I don't know if I've really ever seen a movie, and between the two of us, we've seen a lot of movies that has that sort of look to it, and like moments that I've never seen in any other movie before. I mean, it's just so imaginative and creative and otherworldly.
So
it's almost like these two directors have traveled from across space and time to our planet to share these films with us. And this film, just time and time again, I mean, so many choices are made in this film, even though plot-wise, it's really basic. I mean, it's exactly,
I guess.
Well, plot in the sense that they're right, there's thousands of films that have basically the exact same idea where, you know, guy's in love, he wants to marry a woman for whatever reason, he can't be
and
with
he has
her.
A brain injury, and
he has a major brain injury, he has to go
and he
meet
thinks about heaven. Yeah.
I mean, the basic structure is something that's thousand years old, right? You go back to Midsummer's Night's Dream, or they, of course, they talk about Pyramus and Thisbe, which is what Romeo and Juliet is based off of, all these different things, and they're all built off of the same idea, and yet they take it in this such strange and weird direction. It's so imaginative, and I love all of the black and white cinematography here, which of course the black and white cinematography is the other world. They don't ever
that's what they call
it,
it
heaven, really, or they,
no,
say
they don't call it heaven.
Call it heaven, I think, early on.
It's like a secular heaven.
It's a sort of
it's like
secular
a
heaven,
yeah, it's
which
like,
is more just
yeah,
like an office
world. Or maybe it's not, or maybe it's nothing at all. Maybe it's just an imaginative place that he thought up. That's kind of like the dichotomy of the movie, right? That kind
of
treads you along. Is like the classic movie trope of like, is it real? Is it not real?
Some of those drawings that they use, because a lot of times they'll use miniatures and drawings to sort of cut out. They look so beautiful. I think of that one where they're in the sort of heaven or secular place, wherever, at the beginning of the film, and Bob is waiting for his friend, the captain, into this waiting room, basically.
Yeah, he's in a waiting room, yeah.
And they stand in front of this giant hole.
Yeah,
really,
I love that. Yeah, I love that drawing.
Right?
That's
they cut
amazing.
Back to
the huge
to this
holes.
Amazing, beautiful drawing. And they're on it just long enough it's almost impossible to tell that it's a drawing. It is a drawing, though, because there's no other way you could do it. But it is just this beautiful, magnificent drawing of this library or place where they keep records or who knows what this is. But there's just so many moments like that. And it just feels so giant. Everything in this world feels ginormous, especially in moments like especially in the other world. And I think that's interesting that they point that out, that whenever we're in this black and white other world place, everything is giant and open and minimalistic, and then whenever we cut to the real world, it's almost claustrophobic in the amount of stuff.
I'd say so, yeah. Yeah. And it's also in color,
closed off, and of course it is in that beautiful Technicolor with a lot of greens and yellows and pinks and reds. And so when you kind of move back between these worlds, you almost start asking yourself, you know, which one is the real heaven here? I mean, is this imagined second world the heaven, or is this vibrant, beautiful place? Is Earth our heaven? And then this is sort of our great existence, and everything after this is sort of just bureaucratic, almost Kafka-esque in a sense, in the way that they just move people through the system. And it's unclear what anyone does post leaving.
Apparently it's cool. People like it.
I guess they like it. Everyone's got the same. Cool. It's a socialist world. So that's pretty nice.
I like the other world. I would like to be there if I die.
I think of all the worlds, it seems, I think living in black and white might get a little dull after a while. But
as the guy says, you know, the other world is starved of Technicolor, as the French Fob says later on.
God, I love that French guy. The French revolutionist, or I guess he's not.
Yeah, he's funny.
He's more.
He's funny. That's a funny bourgeoisie character. He has some good lines. He always makes jokes about getting his like head cut off and stuff.
Yeah,
that stuff's funny.
He wears that ascot scarf thing, of course, to signify the decapitation of his own head as part of the bourgeoisie. But I do love this idea that the only reason that our protagonist here survives the plane crash isn't some sort of miracle, or someone has decided, you know, giving him wings.
They don't see him because
they lost him in the fog. They just missed him.
The English fog was too powerful and they missed him. That scene where, by the way, that scene too, before that happens, when they're talking on the plane, like through the radio, what a beautiful scene, man. Amazing.
The lighting of her,
where it's like the light
in
of her
office
in the background and the shadow.
Yeah, and the shadow right over her eyes. Oh,
that's
my
perfect.
God.
Amazing scene.
So many amazing choices are made in this film. I mean, just an infinite number of choices. And that plane, too, looks incredible. And every time they use any sort of special effects, all of the special effects in here are just truly out of this world. And even if you saw these special effects today, you would still be blown away by some of these special effects. I mean, they just look so good. Yeah.
Those stairs, I read a little bit on the Wikipedia page, as I do. And
do.
those stairs were real. I think like they're like 106 steps
that
they made that are just like real. I think like they use like miniatures and other things to like you know, fill up the rest of the stairs. The 106 stairs that they made for nothing, just for the movie. Like that's crazy, bro. What a production.
Oh, yes. Just the willingness to spend exuberant amount of money on incredible set designs and special effects that just look absolutely magnificent. I mean, thinking about those stairs, and it looks like they built those stairs, and then I'm guessing in the back they painted a thing.
Something,
right?
Great
perspective.
And I think it does move too. I think it does have.
It's
the,
got
it,
to
it have the,
right. That's got to be like that's incredible, man. That is just an incredible use of engineering.
And I know, like, I guess, like special effects have gone a long way, where now we can do like car crashes, and like explosions, and you know, pretend to have people get like shot realistically and stuff like that. But I don't know. I just think like for some reason, like the stairs to me are so they're so convincing.
Yeah.
As like an like as a celestial object.
And there's something, you know, I'm starting to wonder that the whole idea of stairs, that can't possibly first have been them, right? That's an idea that goes back in movies.
Oh, like a stairway to heaven or something.
A stairway
like
to heaven
that.
Thing.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
not
yeah.
That's a classic.
That's probably like like something that's been, you know.
We've all seen movies.
I doubt it comes from them.
No, it can't. But arguably the best use of a stairway to heaven.
Like the turn like a literal like term. And you have like those statues too, which is interesting.
Those statues are cool.
Those are cool.
Oh man, I keep coming back to, and I literally just watched this movie before we talked. I woke up early this morning and watched the movie. So it's very fresh on my mind at this moment. And one of my favorite moments is like this little moment that doesn't have a whole lot to do with anything. I mean, it's not a big moment. It's not a moment that changes a lot. But that moment where they're laying in the woods, and it's the first time the French guy comes, and there's those beautiful roses, which roses, like red roses, kind of a big part of this film and in a lot of their work. I mean, you might change their work in color. They're a big fan of roses and flowers. It's sort of one of their motifs, as it were. And the two of them are just laying there, and the French guy comes up, and he has that great line where time is frozen, and the French guy says,
no, we're just in space.
We're just in space, right? Yeah. Time ceases to exist at this moment. Amazing line. Like, truly. Mm-hmm. I mean, an amazing way to explain what is a convoluted situation and in just a few words, and you get it and you understand it and you just accept it as it is. You're like, oh, okay, this is the sort of fantastical world that we live in now. And I love that conversation that they have. I love how he can just continue to persist merely by the use of logic. Right? He basically utilizes logic to talk him out of taking him to heaven. There's no violence, there's no bribery, there's no
fighting.
It's just pure, honest logic.
I like when actors freeze and they clearly are just like, you can tell,
just like not
you can tell
moving.
They kind of waver a little bit. Yeah. Like, yeah.
I mean, they're good
beautiful.
At it, but it's still
they're good.
Wonderful.
No, they still like move like a little bit.
Yeah. And that makes it better. I think it adds
I like it. I love it. Yeah. I love it a lot. You know, I love stuff like that. That stuff's great. Another thing I really like about the movie is that like, like we said, like, he is kind of having these visions where he's talking to the French guy and he's like, you got to go to heaven. You were supposed to die. And that's pretty much the idea of the movie, is that he was supposed to die and he didn't. He evaded it. And they're like, well, now you have to. And he's like, well, no, I'm in love. They have like the doctor friend who's awesome. He's like the best friend in the world. I love his like approach to the situation with the main character, Peter, where he's kind of like believes him, you know, like he kind of he's like, because he explains like, you know, he might be having like these visions and stuff, but to them they're really, really real. So we need to believe him as if it is real. You know, we have to like talk to him as if like it really is happening, and really kind of like entertain the idea that like, as if like it is really happening in the real world. So I just love that approach, and they push it all the way, you know.
Yeah, it's a really great dichotomy where it's sort of the scientific meeting with the spiritual, in that on the one hand, he truly believes that this is a man who's seeing hallucinations and there's something wrong with his brain and they need to do some sort of brain surgery, and they do all these studies and stuff and he's following him around. And yet, not only does he pretend to believe that these fantastical things are happening, but part of him, at least a little bit of him, genuinely is fascinated and interested, and
he's
and
like convincing he's like convincing in his like performance of like believing, of like really entertaining the notion that what he's seeing is real. That character is so good. I love that character. That's like one of the best supporting film characters like ever, the doctor character.
An incredible performance. And I think of them when they're in, again, all of these sets are so strange because they don't ever fit into what we think a set would look like, even when they're simple things like the, I don't know if that's his house or that's his office where they had the ping pong table.
The ping pong scene is really good when they free, like, I love it. Like, yeah, like the it's like his place. Yeah, he like lives there.
So.
And he's like, he seems so focused and wanting to help him. And like you mentioned, the again, like those are all weird details. Another weird detail is when like they're like in the town, right? And I think it's just like a town of like people who are like ally people, like a group of like World War II allies who are
working together.
Because
it's during World War II. I guess we didn't mention that.
Yeah, like you said, they're putting on Midsummer's Night Dream. Obviously, like Shakespeare is like referenced and stuff throughout the film, but that's another weird thing. It's just kind of like it's happening in the background while they're like kind of like talking about these visions. Mm-hmm. It's neither here nor there, I guess. They're just kind of like putting on this like Shakespeare play because just what they're doing. You have that bit where like the director is like help like directing like the actor how to like read the lines like the best way possible. That stuff again is just obviously like there is kind of like a rhyme and reason to it. Like it is kind of, it's not nonsensical. It's still a little bit like random, I guess you could say. Obviously the choice is precise, but it sticks out, I think.
It's certainly otherworldly. And I think this is partly to do with the way the sets are built, is they feel extremely alive and lived in. They don't feel like
sets. Are you talking about when they're on Earth?
I'm talking about when they're on Earth. Yeah.
Okay, gotcha. Okay, yeah. Yeah, they're good.
Like when they're in that hall or whatever, where they're putting on the play, and there's all these people moving around in the background. And I think that's what makes this film so...
It's lively.
Lively. Yeah, is
yeah, it's very cinematic.
People moving around and doing things, and it doesn't feel like so many films where extras are just told, like, let's go back to American Paris. If you ever look in the background, it's just people walking in circles. They're not doing anything, right? And that's most movies. That's you. You pay them to
That's
walk
fine. Most
back
movies
and
are,
forth, and it doesn't matter because they're just adding a little flair. And yet in this film, and it thinks makes me think of a lot of Akira Kurosawa's work, where he was very concerned with how people in the background lived and moved and exist in the world, and would write, you know, entire stories for these background characters and the lives that they lived. And you can sort of feel that here whenever there's extras, particularly on Earth, is, I mean, they're out there acting in the play and they all have these different parts that they're doing, and they're
good.
All moving around. It feels like they're doing their own thing. It doesn't feel as if they're extras acting in the background, walking in circles. Instead, these feel like human beings just living their lives, and we just happen to be there in that moment watching a few people in the foreground of this as they play chess, which of course you can't help but think of Seventh Seal. How do you not think of Seventh Seal?
Chess is like chess is another thing that props up a lot, right? Because of the chess book disappearing and reappearing chess book, right? Which that the chess book is like a clue that might indicate that the other world is real. Like it's not like a thing that he invented in his brain. Because he like takes the chess book and he's like, where did it go? And then like at the very end when he, spoiler alert, he lives, like he's able to live again. He like throws the book from like the staircase, the French guy, and it appears in his pocket and she picks it up. I mean, like maybe it was there before, maybe it wasn't, you know, like we don't really know. That's just like kind of like a little thing to throw in to be like, maybe it is real. But yeah, like chess is like definitely like a thing that pops up, you know, they're playing chess earlier on. And again, that's like another thing that is memorable, it sticks out, but again it feels like a very precise decision, not made haphazardly, a little detail or a little reference. Again, a very intelligent movie. It's so smart, it feels so well constructed and believable. But it is like a movie from like 1946, right? Like it's it has so much feeling in it.
Yeah, all of these little details that feel meaningless in the moment just feel so very specific. I think in that moment where they're playing chess, which is the only time they play chess in the film, even though they talk about chess throughout the film, it's the love interest, they're playing chess together, and she puts him in check as if he's sort of trapped in this place, and yet utilizing his superior wit and intelligence, which is sort of his whole thing here, utilizing logic, even though what's interesting is the reason that he ends in the wind isn't due to logic. It isn't, he's not able to talk his way out of it. It's rather the sacrifices that we're willing to make. But in that moment, of course, he outwits her. And so it's nice to see in the beginning of the film, sort of he's outwitting her, but in the end, it's sort of her sacrifice that she's willing to make that allows love to persist, particularly in these two
characters. Right, that's what happens at the end, right? Like it's not that he proves his love, she proves his love, right? Like it's like a two-way street, right? And it's like very, it's, they're convinced by the end. Honestly though, the saddest part of the movie is when the doctor dies. That sucks. Which, by the way, beautiful foreshadowing, by the way, early on when he's
when
like
they
riding
do
the motorcycle.
I thought he was gonna die the first time.
Yeah, you're like, oh my god, he's gonna crash, but he doesn't crash. But it's beautiful foreshadowing, because when he does crash, it's like, That's how he was going to die, right? Like,
but it all works out. His death allows for the...
He needs a consul. He needs a lawyer, essentially, to defend him. I like, too, because, like, you know, another thing to maybe prove that it's in his mind is, like, Peter wakes up, and he's like, Frank, where is he? And, you know, June is like, he fucking died in a motorcycle accident. And he's like, and then he falls back asleep, and then he imagines him maybe if he hadn't woken up and asked how he is, he wouldn't have appeared, right? Like, they put that little detail in there to ensure that Peter is aware that Frank has died, he has passed on.
I didn't think about that's a really intelligent moment. I guess I didn't think about that's such a clever little thing that sort of beats out our arguments of this.
It goes either way, right? Like, there's like good details to maybe convince you that it is a real place. There's details that convince you that it's all in his brain.
Gosh. And that moment when they're at the trial in that giant room.
Oh, yeah. The trial is like a 25-minute scene.
Great scene. It, of course, reminds me of the devils in that trial scene.
That's a good
also
point.
Giant trial, although in this one they get people of different nationalities and ethnicities.
It's basically the point of the trial, the point of the majority of the arguments that are made in the trial are that British people are terrible.
They're good arguments. It's kind of an argument about colonization, which
was
is
so
great.
Funny.
The jury Oh my God, I love that moment.
Yeah, like they first like the so the guy who is like the who is
The prosecutor.
the prosecutor, right? He's trying to prosecute Peter, the guy who first died by like a British
The very first
bullet.
person to die, yeah, in the
The first
American
like American
Revolution.
guy who died by a British guy, yeah, which is just like okay, like, and they he so he does it, and yeah, he's great. One detail, by the way, that I saw from the Wikipedia page that I thought was interesting: the guy who plays the judge is the same actor who plays the surgeon,
Really?
which I didn't
Oh.
notice that at first. I never noticed that. They're not really like the guy wears a mask most of the time,
Right, so you can't
and he
really
takes his
tell.
mask off, but
Oh yeah,
I
towards the
really.
end. I guess I miss. I guess I
I
didn't
guess
notice
I'm. I
that.
guess the viewer is supposed to be like, "Oh my God, it's the same guy!" But I didn't. I was reading the Wikipedia page and I saw that, and I was like, "Oh fuck, that's
Wow.
crazy."
Again, just another like little detail that makes you wonder, is this real or is this just some sort of great fantastical imagination?
And either way, though, it either way, it's satisfying. Like the movie is still like satisfying either way.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter, yeah, whether it's real or not. But yeah, like the trial scene is so great. And again, you were talking about like the huge extras and stuff like that the huge amount of extras and how they like divided them all into like different groups to sit together. That stuff's funny.
That stuff's truly wonderful. And I love when they change the jury from the original colonized countries to all the Americans. But then, of course, it's just these same people, but now they've been, right? The idea is that America is this melting pot, blah 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 blah. It's like,
Yeah,
you know what
America
I mean?
rocks. Yeah, and I was like, yeah, as an American, I'm like, oh, that's
Yeah,
right. Like British
America.
people's. I think his point is he's trying to point out that his background means a lot to Peter as to why or why not he deserves to be given another chance to live. And he's like, look, he's a British guy, and British have done all these like, look at this long list of things that they've done. Which, hey, you know, it's
I mean,
somewhat convincing.
he's not wrong. The British have done a lot wrong to a lot of people. But the counter argument when he has an entire American jury, the point he's trying to make is that it doesn't really matter where we come from, or it doesn't really matter what our ancestors do. We can't change what happened
Right.
in the past, and we can only sort of move in the future, and we need to sort of fight for love and betterment of humankind over this idea of, and I think that's kind of interesting too, is prosecutor has this prejudice towards England,
Right.
and then the doctor sort of flips that around to point out, well, you know, if you have this prejudice, and of course he does it again and again with like George Washington, right, was British, your grandmother was British,
Yeah.
the idea that the melting pot, blah 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 blah, but also just this idea of what it means to be human. And it's not sort of a as much, you know, here's how great America is and nationalistic thing, more of just we're all human on this planet, and it doesn't really matter what name you put in front of us, we have all those same feelings and that
It's a
idea
very
of
humanist
love. Yeah,
message. Yeah.
absolutely.
I just love when he takes down the British people. Like, I just find that stuff so funny and
That's
so
a
like
very
fun to watch.
satisfying moment.
It's a very satisfying moment when he's like, the British people are this, that. Or like when they play the radios, which that's just like, huh? Like
I didn't get
what's the
that
point of
part.
it? That joke got a little like what? Like I think it's just saying like this is what they're listening to on the radio. It's garbage, you know, like but for both ways. But that didn't really age all that well. I guess it's just saying like it's garbage, it's trash, it's like junk food.
I guess that's sort of what is, and sort of maybe the idea that the British radio is this boring, dull
Yeah, it
nonsense,
sucks.
and then the
And then they're playing like
American
rock and pop music or
is
whatever, and they're
sort of
like,
this
oh, what's
pop,
going on?
overly sexualized
Yeah.
idea. I guess
Wait 100 more
I'm not
years and
sure.
you know, yeah.
It's a little unclear what's the radio thing. That part definitely goes over my head. I mean, most of the stuff is very relevant, and like I said, this film in a lot of ways feels very modern, but it's one of
It's
those,
just a joke that doesn't land particularly for me,
it
but
just
it's fine. I get it. It's just that it's not a funny joke.
doesn't
But I think the movie overall is like really funny, and it's surprisingly funny. I found myself laughing a lot, even when it's like, even though the movie is a very like felt film with a lot going on emotionally underneath, and the trial has like a really like a good source of, again, when they like cut to like the big groups of people and they're all like moving around doing the same
They all do
thing.
the same
That's just
thing
good comp. That's just
simultaneously.
good comedy.
That's
The
good
pilgrims
comedy.
too. I like the pilgrims.
The pilgrims with the giant hats. I love the, I don't know if they're like the, no, they're like the French revolutionists because they have the flag and they're all like
Oh,
scrappy.
yeah. You're
All
right.
those groups are amazing and imaginative and weird. And it's one of those films that, even though it's a funny film, it's never telling a joke necessarily. I mean, it's never like American in Paris, like, you know, where we're like, here's the punchline, here's the joke. It's more nuanced, I guess. Even though some of the jokes are
it has
very,
a good British humor sensibility.
Yeah,
I
guess it has that British humor to it. They are almost bland when they sort of tell their jokes, but it lands.
Yeah, it's
it
like dry
works.
Humor.
Dry humor, yeah, that's the word I was looking for. But definitely inspiration from the likes of Buster Keaton. I mean, I can't help but think of that Buster Keaton short where he's in a movie theater and he's watching himself on the screen. Have you seen that short before?
You're talking about Sherlock Jr., right?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, I
no,
think
that's a
Sherlock
classic
Jr.
one.
Yeah. And
Yeah.
there's all those versions of Buster Keaton. I don't know why that's the first thing that came to my mind when I saw this, but maybe it's
It
just
didn't for me, so
interpretation.
I don't know.
So it's just a weird
That's cool.
connection
No,
that
I
I
see
made,
what you
but
I see where you're coming from. When you watch the movie, it has like a multitude of different things that are going on that you can't help but like think of various things. I just find the movie to be kind of inconspicuously like intelligent, right? Like it
yeah.
doesn't I think it's smart, but it doesn't really play its hand that it's super smart. Because there are a lot of other movies like this where it's like
they're showing off.
Yeah, showing off. Like I guess like an example, an obvious example would be, you know, Nolan's Inception.
Yeah.
I love that movie. But it's kind of dumb. You know, like it's kind of dumb, like the way that it kind of does the dream within a dream thing. Like it doesn't really like make a whole lot of sense. Well, I guess like, you know, not that it needs to make sense.
I
It's
mean,
just
Nolan's
that.
Memento does the same thing too, right?
Yeah, yeah. Like
Or
Nolan's
showing
other
off.
movies. Like, yeah. I guess it's showing off. You know, like showing off is like, I love all these movies.
Good movies.
It's just that movie gets lost in kind of
Its
the,
own logic.
yeah, its own logic, its own construction, its architecture. You kind of get lost in it a little bit. You know, if I had to like, again, I love these movies very, very much. I'm going to watch them again and again. But Matter of Life and Death, it's not like that at all. I don't think it really gets lost at all in its sort of convoluted plot and setup and construction, especially since I think when you have like that especially when you have like there's this world and then there's this world. There's a fine line between them. I think that helps a lot to kind of help the viewer.
Yeah, I think that was a very intelligent move to choose everything in this other world to be in black and white, and also very different design. Of course, we talk about this sort of minimalistic style just to help separate these two worlds that they both live in. And I know I've talked about Shakespeare quite a lot on this one, and I think partly it's on my mind because I've been working on Macbeth with my kids for the past 4 or 6 weeks now, and we're really, I mean, in the depths of Macbeth at this point. And I talk about this a lot with my kids of how, yes, Shakespeare's work is really fascinating and intelligent, and there's these amazing, beautiful lines. But the thing is, we've built Shakespeare today to be this very scholarly,
highfalutin
thing.
Like, it's really quite simple, is what you're saying.
Exactly, right? I think it's the same thing here, where
yeah.
even though it's steeped in its own, in this case, cinematic history, other than literature
yeah.
history, Shakespeare, a lot of his work references work from the past, particularly work of
right.
mythology and the like. The people who went and saw Shakespeare were just your everyday, right, mocho. They were just your everyday person who didn't know all of these fancy words or these
the
big
broad
names.
Strokes are clear.
Exactly.
The broad message. The
and
broad,
it's still enjoyable.
Yeah.
I mean, it's no
yeah,
less
yeah.
enjoyable to someone, whether they have seen Midsummer Night's Dream or read Midsummer Night's Dream, or they know about these cinematic references. It doesn't matter to the
yeah.
piece. And yet, if you do know it, it just adds these layers that just make it all of the
right.
the stronger. So it works on this really weird level in a way a lot of films don't. And we think of stuff like Nolan's Inception, or there's other directors that do it. It's not just Christopher Nolan. I know we're giving a lot of shit on Christopher Nolan, but
probably the most
it's
successful director,
most
like in the
successful,
past like 20
well-known
years, like top five,
modern
like most
director.
Successful director. Yeah, think about Shakespeare too. Is that like, you know, its success is still evident at this point, not just in
yeah.
scholarly, but his stories are always been like being adapted into movies, not literally, but like, you know, being adapted into like more modern retellings, right? Like.
Yeah.
That's evidence of its like power, even when it's not necessarily like using like his verbatim writing per se.
Yeah.
You can still like tell an effect of a story if you just like incorporate the broad strokes and like, you know, lay it over like whatever location or time period or language, whatever it is. And, you know, Matter of Life and Death, kind of the same thing, right? Where, you know, again, you could get lost into the fabric of like, oh, is it real? Is it not? Da, 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 da. But ultimately, you know, the message is very convincing, which is power of love is palpable enough to keep you from not dying. I'm kidding, but that's, you know,
yeah,
you know what I mean.
The idea is strong. And a part that confused me a little bit, I mean, there's a lot of things that like you could really dig into, but they say they need proof of the love, and they take
yeah.
a tear from
I know that's a beautiful
her.
Image where they take the tear and put it on
wonderful
the
image
flower.
But then I don't think they ever use the tear. I think it just I don't think they
that's
ever.
Okay. That's okay. That's okay.
I mean,
really
it doesn't
bother
matter.
me on that
I don't
much.
care. I'm not
But it,
just
it,
like,
you're
look.
right. I thought the same thing. It's like, huh, I wonder what happened to the beautiful
Because I thought
image.
that was going to be, the big thing, the big reveal. Oh, but we have this tear that proves that it's love.
Right. But
Instead,
I
we
like the
actually live
reveal
for
more.
that.
I like the reveal more at the end where it's like she has to make a decision to
Yeah, I
prove
think that's
her
better.
love. So
Yeah.
that's beautiful. And they're like going up the stairs and they're like, all right, all right, all right. You know, like, you know, you get
You
fine.
proved
We'll
your
let you
point.
live
Yeah.
for however much longer or whatever.
It reminds me of this film that I watched not too long ago when I was extraordinarily sick. I mean, I was just the sickest I've been in quite a while. And when I'm sick, the one nice thing about being sick is that you get a chance to watch movies. And I always watch musicals when I'm sick. It makes me feel good. And I don't want to watch something sad or hard to understand when I'm feeling awful. And I watched Brigadoon, which is another Gene Kelly film. And it has this sort of same bright Technicolor world. And the whole plot of Brigadoon is that this city in Scotland or Ireland, one of those two places, I can never tell the difference.
You would make a lot of Irish people mad,
I
a lot
know,
of Irish
I'm
and Scottish
sorry.
people mad. I
Apologies
can't
to
tell
all
the
our
difference
Irish
between
and Scottish listeners, but
them.
it has nothing to do with any of you. It's my American ignorance that is at the
Right,
core of this problem. So it's a me
That's fair
problem,
enough.
not anyone else's problem. But the idea of Brigadoon is that it's the city that's put under a curse in like the late 1700s, and they only wake up once every 100 years, and they live for a day,
Okay.
and then they go to sleep for another 100 years.
That sounds like a Star Trek plot.
It's very strange. It's this weird lakeside fantasy thing. But Gene Kelly and his friend fumble around along this world, and they spend a day there, and it takes them the whole film to figure out that this curse is real and figuring out this whole thing. But then at the end of the film, he decides to leave because he decides that he can't stay there. He wants to see his friends and family and go back into the real world. He doesn't want to stay in this 18th century magical land. So he goes back in the real world. He goes back to New York City. It's all loud and screaming and all this. And he feels sad. So he travels back to where Brigadoon is. But of course, those people won't wake up for another 100 years. But here's the spoiler. His love is
Oh
so
no.
strong that he wakes up the city for a moment.
Wow.
Just
It's
so
so
he can enter
powerful.
it.
That's beautiful.
So I think
Wow.
it'd be a great double feature with this film, honestly. They have some very similar ideas of love, and they both play with like 17th century, and there's some
Like
Shakespearean stuff going on,
the
but
power of love thing is like
universal.
I go back and forth between it because it's like I feel really cynical about it. And I'm just like, yeah, right. The power of love like saved the day. It's a very common thing that happens and in movies that you see a lot, like the power of love, it is able to transcend the universe and do this or that. You know, like just for me, you know, I can't help but like be cynical like half the time. Like a movie like Interstellar is, I think, a
Yeah.
movie that does that to reference another Nolan
Another Nolan
movie.
movie.
God damn, where I'm like, where the concept of like love being able to transcend time or whatever in that movie is just so kind of like, okay, you know, like I can't help but feel a little cynical. Matter of Life and Death is a good example of a movie where it's just like it's hard for me to be cynical about like it's crux.
Yeah, and I wonder why it works in this film when it doesn't work in so many others. And part of me,
It's just convincing.
yeah, it's convincing, but I think part of it too is the core of this movie is about love and what love means. And yet the plot hinges not on necessarily the power of love, but the choices that we make as people. And I think it's this the choice instead of sort of the idea of love itself bringing someone back to life or surviving or this sort of thing, or bringing a town back. Instead, it's
You still have to
her
act on
making that
it.
choice. You have to act on the love. And I think that's it right there. And I think it's also the way this film portrays love, which I think is a very and arguably one of the most accurate portrayals of love I've ever seen, because often,
Very
especially
endearing.
in this era, love, I mean, let's go back to America and Paris. It can be a very one-sided thing, or it can be a
It's not very it's not like like the relationship between like the Gene Kelly and the love interest is like it starts with like her him badgering her and like bothering her and stuff like that, which I don't mind that just because like which in that movie isn't great. There are some other movies though, like have you ever seen like Elaine May's The Heartbreak Kid? Maybe not The Heartbreak Kid. There's like other movies like you know what? Albert Brooks is, it's funny I'm mentioning Albert Brooks because he has another movie that is very similar to this called Defending Your Life, which is very much like this movie
Okay.
where a guy dies and he wakes up in a secular heaven and he has to argue that he had a very kind of like life that gave back to people so that he can move on to heaven. Otherwise, he'll be reincarnated. And he falls in love with Meryl Streep and he wants to go with her and stuff. Very, very similar movie. He has another movie called Modern Romance. which is like another movie that like is like about love, it's about romance, it's about human relationships, but Albert Brooks' his character is insanely jealous and he's insanely insipid and he is like all over the place and he's like a complete wreck about his relationship with this woman. And that's kind of like the other side of it. And it's a great movie and it's hilarious and it feels, you know, real, right? Like that's another yeah. side of it where it's like, yeah, like love is kind of like this messy sort of like thing that kind of eats at you and that is like really confusing. But then like love, like in a matter of life and death, though, is like a powerful thing too. And it can do good things as well.
Yeah. It just works. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, we can talk all day about reasons why we think it works, but it just really works in all the ways.
And the production, the directing, everything about the movie is pretty helpful in selling that.
Yeah,
as well.
For sure. Right. These are clearly two masterful directors at the peak of their brilliance in some ways, and at least for the type of story that they're telling here. Of course, they go on to make a lot more famous films like Peeping Tom and the like, but it's definitely captured.
Well, Peeping Tommy, Tom. Pal made that by himself.
Right. Pal made that one by himself.
But I love that movie.
Yeah. But
the movie's a little bit less.
It's different.
Yeah, it's different. It's a little violent, I guess you could say. That movie's also kind of about love in a way. Like,
in a way.
You know, that's like the other side. Yeah.
Yeah. But gosh, should we give some final thoughts for this? We've been on it for
yeah, yeah. Go ahead, yeah.
Okay. Well, as you may have guessed, I absolutely adore this film, and I think what made this experience all the better is I watched it this morning. I woke up early and I was exhausted, very tired. So there's this very dreamlike quality to this piece, and yeah. So watching this when you're still sort of gathering your senses back, and it's such a surreal experience. It's as if I'm still dreaming in this weird way. And you think of some of those scenes, you have to think, surely that has to be out of a dream. I mean, it's so weird and almost convoluted that you would never think this would exist in the real world or actually created by actual yeah. human beings and not aliens who have traveled to this planet. So fascinatingly brilliant. And the Technicolor, I mean, my God, this is some of the best Technicolor I have ever seen. And just the use
yeah,
of color and black and white too. I think they use black and white to really great effect in this film. And then I have a big problem with Technicolor of this era, the 1940s and 50s, because a lot of the times it's only shot in Technicolor because they don't know what else to do and they're not very good at it and it doesn't look good.
Mm-hmm.
But this film looks absolutely
it's
magnificent.
Purposeful.
It's a purposeful and brilliant use of color here. And we talk about how lively this world seems. I mean, all of our extras feel diverse and deep and multidimensional, even if they just have these tiny roles or don't say anything at all. One of my favorite moments in this piece is when they're talking about A Midsummer Night's Dream and they're in that hall
yeah.
or looking at any of these sets because they're just so imaginative. I mean, it's not the way you think sets would look and very modern looking too. I mean, some of these rooms, they don't feel like they're rooms from the 1930s or 1940s. They feel like rooms you would see today and the beautiful greenery and the plants and all this stuff and masterful direction and cinematography. I mean, there's really every piece of this, it just feels like we have masters from these different worlds that have all come together
yeah.
and shaped by these two fantastic directors at the peak of their sort of career together. Of course, they go on to make a lot of work independently too, and would still make some films together. But most famously, of course, The Red Shoes. But this film just feels like everything a movie should be and needs to be. And I think I'm going to do it. I'm going to give it a 10 out of 10. I think
wow.
it's
awesome. I think that's a very correct rating. I'll give it like a 9 out of 10 for me, but like, yeah, 10 out of 10 is like really not that like far off just because like, it's just a crazy movie. It's just kind of unbelievable, you know, and everything that it does, you know, it's surprisingly funny. It's surprisingly moving. Really good, kind of like, you know, very typical like performances of its time. But like, I think all the characters are really like lovable and amazing. And yeah, just like amazing special effects. Great lighting and like you said, like cinematography as well. It's just photographed beautifully, whether it's in color or in black and white. We talked a lot about like kind of like the story and a lot of like the amazing like details and writing that they have going on throughout that really makes a film super engaging and fun to watch. Like you're really like having like a really good time watching it. It's a movie that I could easily be cynical about, but I just for some reason I just like cannot.
Even Andrew can't be cynical.
Even I can't be cynical about it. Just because everything about it is in its favor to its goal and the story and like messages trying to tell. So, you know, you got to give it 9 out of 10. You know, it's amazing.
All right. Well, thank you all for listening to another incredible episode. You can find everything I do at Austin Lugo.
I am on Letterboxd, Retro Andrew, RETR0 Andrew.
And you can find this podcast wherever you hear podcasts. You can also find us on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube at With Nothing to Say. And thank you all for listening.
Thanks again.